Support for this public radio podcast comes from AIG Travel Guard, providing travel insurance designed to help travelers face the unexpected. Learn more at travelguard.com.
I'm Dick Gordon. Coming up, the story of a life in America's oil fields. Gary Iden has broken his back and his leg, and he's been burned over much of his body in his 30 years as a roughneck. It's work that he still does with his own father, roughnecking in Wyoming, and he loves it. He took his own son, Tug, into the compressor stations and the gas fields when he was barely old enough to walk. Young Tug inherited a fascination and a love for the life of a roustabout, and he thought he might just skip college and start right out of high school.
And I remember talking to my mom and my dad one evening, saying, you know, I could put off college for a few years, and here pretty soon I could be drilling on a rig and pushing tools. And I remember Dad just very vividly saying,
I'm an example of what you don't want to be. You want to be able to walk when you're older.
Tug Iden went to college and now works the oil fields from a desk rather than the wellhead. I'll talk with father and son about the love for oil. That's right after the news. For most of us, the price of oil translates pretty directly to gas for the car, heat for the home, and bigger bills than most of us have ever paid for all that. Most of us are at what they call the downstream end of the business. We're the consumers. Gary Iden and his son Tug work at what they call the upstream end. They search and they drill for the oil and the gas, and ever since the prices jumped, they've been jumping as well. Gary's been a roughneck for 30 years. It's a dangerous business.
You know, people ask me what it's like to work in a oil and gas field, I tell them it's very simple. You know, you just go home and snap off all your gas mains, let them fill your house full of natural gas, and then you walk around in 6 inches of condensate and oil and gasoline, but you go ahead and make your supper and stuff, because we use fires also. So that's quite a combination.
The danger of oil work is currently on the big screen as the film There Will Be Blood takes an historic look at the early days of wildcatting.
A whole ocean of oil under our feet. No one can get at it except for me.
If we do find oil here, this community of yours will not only survive, it will flourish.
We'll move the story of the roughneck ahead to the current days of $90 a barrel oil and take a look inside the real dangers and the questions faced by a family that works the oil fields of Wyoming. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story.
The Story is produced by North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC. It's co-produced and distributed by American Public Media.
The Iden family has been in the oil business for decades now. Gary Iden's been working as a roughneck for 30 years. These days of expensive oil means there's lots of work around, but there were many years when men were forced to travel thousands of miles from home to find work.
I've turned down a lot of big money because I don't move, but I had too many kids and they meant too much to me, so I just stayed where I was at. The drilling end of it runs 24 hours a day, 365 days a year, so there's a lot of people especially with the drilling rigs, that's what they did, is they'd be in Big Piney for a month or 2 months and they get shipped down to Vernal, Utah, or go down to Texas, and they just follow them around, leave their families there, and most of that ended up pretty tragic for the family.
Talk to me a little bit about just how physically difficult this job is or can be. I mean, if you were to sit down in a doctor's office and the nurse hands you that piece of paper that says list your physical injuries over the past few years, what would that list look like for you?
I've been burnt. I had bones broken, blew out an eardrum. You know, that was my fault. Lots of cuts and abrasions. I've been blown up.
Blown up? What was that?
Well, when after a workover rig leaves, we open the vent or vent the well out to the just to the atmosphere. We blow it into a pit to catch all the material coming out. And then we usually have a fire that's in the pit that it'll burn the natural gas and the gasoline off. I was young and being stupid, and our fire went out, so I just let everything run, kept on going while I got a new barrel of diesel. And what you do is you just stick a propane torch down there to light your diesel fire, and away you go. But usually you shut the well in. But I didn't do that, so all that whole pit I had, it was full of natural gas and gasoline. And so when I took that propane torch and stuck it into that pit, it was a heck of a big boom. You know, blew me back 15, 20 feet. And these guys in the movies see where they get blown out of houses or blown up all the time. Them repercussions hurt, boy. take my word for that.
You were lucky to survive that.
Yeah. Yeah. Some of them are just amazing. How some people walk away and then you get such little incidents that happen that that'll take someone's life. You know, and my dad's been the same way. You know, he's been had broken bones. And
what bones have you had broken, Gary?
I had a leg busted. I was walking down between a pipeline. We was putting a pipeline together, and I was about a half mile ahead of the welders and stuff. I was inspecting the ditch, and something happened back at the welders, and they kicked the pipeline off of the skids that it was on. And a pipeline is just like a snake when you turn it loose. Any kind of pipe, 2-inch, bigger. Anyway, it come whipping down the ditch, and I didn't hear it. It hit me and threw me across the ditch, and I know it hurt like a devil. But I didn't know it was broke till a couple years later. I got an x-ray for another thing. They said, hey, you know, you had this leg broke at one time. So, because I got bone spurs sticking out the back of my leg, my bone, so.
How is your back, Gary?
It's in bad shape. It is in really bad shape. I had surgery on it 5 years ago, and it takes a lot to get out of bed in the morning. It takes a lot to sleep. Carry special pillows around me to drive equipment with. That's usually the one thing that when your back is gone, you're pretty much done. When I broke my back, my back doc told me there's only one other industry that they've known in the world that compares to oil field back, and that's the slaves that built the pyramids. Their backs were in the same shape, so it's very, very physically demanding.
Tell me something, though. You really love this job. What is it that you love about it?
The adrenaline rush is always there. You know, something's always blowing up, blowing out, and falling off. The sense of danger, I guess, that you're working in all the time. And plus, I love working. It's just, for somebody who loves working and putting in a lot of hours and like tough work and challenging work, it's very exciting.
Gary Iden's son, Tug, grew up in those Wyoming oil fields. His father would take him out to where he and his uncles and his grandfather were working. He says the men never talked much about the danger, although Tug remembers when his father was badly burned by chemicals in a sour gas well that was out of control.
I got home from school and then actually went over to my grandfather's office, and I was told that my mom had to go somewhere, and that we were told just to kind of wait around. There was something going on. Nobody really said what, but it was obviously pretty serious. And later that evening, I remember my mom's a pretty strong woman for raising three boys and a girl. And myself and my two brothers, we were about as wild and crazy growing up as you could be. And my mom's a strong lady, but she was obviously shooken up that day. And I didn't find out till later what had happened. Found out Dad had actually been out on a blowout. And a blowout is really, if you watch those old movies or you see old pictures of gushers where it's blowing all the oil in the air, that's essentially what was going on. And it's a deadly situation, blowing a lot of oil and gas over hundreds of square feet on your location, and all it takes is one spark and everybody's dead. And basically he was standing in a lake of gasoline trying to fit a certain set of valves on top of this well that would actually close the well off. And while he was doing this, it was blowing gas, and he was midway up his calf in this crude oil.
We had rain gear on, and we had special eye protection gear on, but you couldn't see with that stuff. And when you looked down, the gas would drop into your glasses, back up into your eyes. And about 1:32 o'clock in the morning, I fell down in this goop that was laying on the ground, and then later on I had to lay right in it to try to get this fitting to seal off. And I knew there was things burning. I could feel them burn, but just at that time the adrenaline's going so much it doesn't bother you. And there was another roughneck there with me, and he was one of these studs that are, you know, going blow, and he had his shirt on. He didn't have no raincoat or nothing on it. And come to find out there was some caustic material coming out of the well, blowing out of the well, and it filled my rain suit and burned my arms and had my eyes treated. We finally got the well contained. I went to the doghouse and looked, and I could see with a bunch of the hide had come off my arms and wrists. And so they took us to the hospital, and they just bandaged me up, sent me home. But the other guy, they actually had to life-flighted him onto a bigger hospital because he was in really bad shape.
You do. Yeah. You still have the scars from this, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. My arms and chest and stuff, just trying to get a real bad sunburn. Anywhere that the elastic was tight, those chemicals would burn the skin, and the elastic would take the skin off, then it would re-burn it, and it has some pretty deep scars in places.
Tug, let me turn back to you. You grew up watching your dad get burned, having his bones broken, his back wrecked, cuts, hearing loss, and yet you still wanted to be a roughneck yourself.
I did, essentially, yeah.
I mean, the other kids wanted to be a fireman or an astronaut or a policeman, and you wanted to be a roughneck, right?
I did. I have vivid memories of being in school, and the teacher would ask what we want to do for the rest of our lives. I was always, well, I want to work in the oil field. You get weird looks from the teacher and weird looks from the students. So, yeah, at the same time, I have drawings from when I was 4 and 5 years old of complete well setup. So we have the well and the different facilities on the location. And this was at the same time where I think most other kids would have drawn houses and family pictures, and not Tug. Tug was drawing drilling rigs and gas wells on his pieces of paper.
Early on, you took your son, Tug, out to the oil fields with you, right? How old would he have been when you first took Tug out to the oil fields?
He was probably, I'd take him with me when he was 2, but then he actually started working with me when he was 3. Going with me, I had his booster seat in right beside me, and he had his own set of earmuffs that I bought for him, so he'd go check compressors, and then he had a hard hat, too, and Tug was a big boy when he was born. So he could almost fit into a regular hard hat when he was 3. But he used to go out and walk around the compressors with me and check stuff, you know, and always asking questions. You know, what does this do and how does that, and what this fitting was and what that was for. And actually, for a young kid, it was very good questions. Anytime I'd learn something new in the field, we'd go grab Tug up and take him out there and show him. And just from the very beginning, he was just enthralled with what was doing, you know. He just loved when I blow a well down. That means sometimes so much water getting in a pipe column, the gas can't come up. So he just open it to the atmosphere and blow it up. And it just looks like a fountain that sprays water 150 feet in the air or 100 feet in the air. And it's kind of cool to watch. So we used to just sit there and pick up and watch them blow down, you know. And yeah, he had a good time.
Those are some of the earliest memories, not only the visual sights of it, but the smells as well. We call it condensate, but it's actually a light crude oil. And this oil, it has a real pungent smell. And so there's a little of it that comes out with the water. And so with the visual of that geyser, that fountain, and the smell of the crude, it just gets in your blood.
Tug Iden says he started working in the oil fields of Wyoming just about as soon as he had the opportunity. And he did well. It looked like he was going to get his own rig to operate. And that's when he had this conversation with his father about work at the wellhead and working in the classroom. We'll talk to them about what happened next in just a moment. I'm Dick Gordon from American Public Media. This is The Story. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story. The rumbles of a recession are spreading fear through financial markets, and they've also brought the price of oil down from its $100 a barrel high point to somewhere in the range of $90 a barrel. But the people in the business of hunting for that oil are still as busy as they've ever been. It's traditionally been one of America's boom and bust industries, and my two guests today are a father and a son who take us inside both the attraction and the dangers of roughnecking in the oil fields of Wyoming. The father, Gary Iden, says he worries that whenever there's a lot of money around, that's when you get people who are drunk or high or inexperienced on the job. They don't care because even if they get fired, they know they'll get another job.
You got to be careful of a dairy can that'll sit up there and smokes his lunch or shoots his lunch or something, and then he forgets to snap his belt back on, you know, and he takes a 85 swan dive off the, you know, with a couple gainers onto the floor of the rig.
Have you seen
stuff
that
like
happen?
That. Yes. In our area, we probably get 5 or 6 fatalities a year. We've got a special tool called a wireline tool that we use in a rig, and we use the wire goes through pulleys or shivs, I was working at about 20 below zero, and just a guy out there, inexperienced, and he didn't let go of that wire, and he'd run his fingers right through that shiv on one hand. And it hurt him, naturally, so he took his glove off, what was left of his glove, and just flung it because it hurt so bad, and not thinking that his fingers were still in his glove tips. Well, that spread them fingers out all over the location, you know, so he was out there in 4 inches of snow trying to locate all of his fingers so they could get him sewed back on, and we never did find all of his fingers. I think we were short one. Us in the mining industry vie for first place all the time in who's the worst industry to be in. You know, they're either the top killers or we're the top killers, and it's a dangerous industry.
There's very rarely when something happens in the oil field where it's clean. I think any time there is a fatality, it's going to be actually really gruesome. There's an old adage that says you can always tell an old roughneck by what he lacks, not by what he has, and you'll see a lot of guys that are missing toes or fingers or teeth.
Tug, in the short time that you spent in the field, did you ever see any accident yourself?
Yeah, I have seen accidents. I've seen a lost thumb once and some knocked out teeth, but no, never. I never got to see anybody killed, and I'm kind of thankful for that.
Despite the dangers, Tug Iden's earliest and fondest memories of the oil field are those trips he made to work with his father when he was just a toddler.
I remember being small enough that I'd have trouble sometimes crawling over pipelines. And those lines at the time aren't very big. They're 8 or 10 inches in diameter, and I'd have to crawl over them. I remember that pretty vividly. And as well, some of the facilities on the individual wells themselves, it looks like small propane tanks that separate the oil and the gas and the waters that come out of the ground. I remember one instance where Dad had actually dropped a wrench in the back, and he couldn't reach it, and I actually crawled behind this tank, if you will, and got that wrench for him. Those really are my earliest memories.
You're lucky, though. I mean, for a young kid to go to work with his dad like that, I'm sure there are people listening who, you know, fathers who wish they could have taken their sons along and sons who wish they could have gone.
Oh, yeah.
Just from the very moment he started, he was just... Tug is one of the lucky ones that he always knew what he wanted to do. Yeah, well, like myself, for example, I'm still looking what I want to do when I grow up. So,
okay, well, wait a second. Let me stop you there. Were you thinking all along that Tug would end up doing the same work that you were doing? Did you want him at that time to be a roughneck?
No, not at all. I always tell my kids my story when I quit my senior year of college. And you come to a fork in roads sometimes, and some people take the right forks and some people take the wrong ones. And I took the wrong one, so I had to come up the ladder the hard way. You know, I didn't just step out and have a company recruit me and give me $250,000 a year and say, get after it, you know.
But Gary, your work as a roughneck has put 4 kids through college. I mean, there's a lot of people who can't say that they were able to accomplish that through their own sweat and strength.
I put in a lot of hours on it also.
Yeah.
When I turned 40, we figured I had enough hours of a person that was 60 years old.
I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Story. As Gary Iden was saying, he quit college in his senior year, and so despite the fact that his eldest son, Tug, wanted nothing more than his own life in the oil fields, his dad, Gary, wanted him to stay in school. Tug says the trouble was that he was having too much fun and making money.
My dad and my grandfather allowed me to work with them, so I was doing the same thing Dad had been doing for the past couple of decades. I was driving trucks, operating heavy machinery. I was working on compressor stations, the wells, the production stuff, also handling equipment and helping out on drilling rigs. Really, everything that Dad had been doing, I was now doing, and I kind of thought that was about the best it could get.
What were you thinking, Tug? Were you thinking, why bother going to college? This is the life that I want? What was going through your mind?
I knew, really, I didn't want to be a roughneck for the rest of my life. Dad and I had enough discussions about that. But then after I graduated high school, I actually went and worked on a drilling rig and roughnecked for a little while. I loved that. It was a lot of heavy work. It was dangerous work. The very first adrenaline rush was I'd only been roughnecking for about a month, and we were without a derrick man. And on a rig crew, a derrick man is the guy that works up in that tower on a drilling rig, and he has to move the pipe around, really. And so we were without that. And the tool pusher took me up there. to kind of get a picture, you're standing on your heels on this board overhanging the rig floor. It's a metal rig floor. You're 80 to 120 feet up in the air. And in Wyoming, the wind constantly blows. So you got this whistle going around you, and you're absolutely scared to death. And I remember I thought, oh, I'm going to die. Something's going to happen. My parents are going to kill me. They'll just dump my body somewhere because I didn't listen to them. But I'd actually done a good enough job that I was offered within a couple of years to have my own rig to manage. And I remember talking to my mom and my dad one evening saying, you know, I could put off college for a few years and here pretty soon I could be drilling on a rig and pushing tools. And I remember Dad just very vividly saying, well, we're proud of you for that, but you don't want to do that for the rest of your life. You need to think a little bit more about it.
Let me turn back to Gary. You remember this time when Tug was talking about the chance to have his own rig? I mean, I can almost imagine the scene. He's explaining he has this great opportunity and he'll have his own rig and he'll be so young and he'll, you know, what are you thinking?
There's a couple things Tug didn't tell you. That crew he was working with, they all got busted for DUIs and meth possession and I don't know what else they were smoking, toking, poking or something. But anyway, Tug ended up, he was the youngest guy in the crew. And Tug come home from work one day and says, you know, Dad, I need to borrow the car. I said, really, how come? He says, well, all these guys are in jail and stuff, and they can't drive. They took their driver's license away. So we had an old Cadillac at then. So he was taking the Cadillac out there 30 miles in the desert and toting his boss around, you know.
So what are you thinking, that it's just a matter of time before Tug gets in the same kind of trouble that his guys are in?
No, it's just he was just had more potential than just to be a roughneck. You know, and I take education very, very seriously, and I feel it's as part of my job as a dad is to get them all educated and then they can do what they want to do. And I keep telling my kids that I'm an example of what you don't want to be. You want to be able to walk when you're older, and I think that caught on there, and I think that's what motivated Tug.
Sometimes it's tough to make that case, though, because your son looks up to you. You might not have finished school, but he likes the work that you're doing. You're working with your dad. He's thinking, I could do the same thing. So you're saying go to school even though you didn't do it, right?
Mm-hmm.
What were you thinking, Tug?
It did. It took some prodding to get me, I think, to take school more seriously. I really wanted to just do what Dad was doing. You build up this romance with it where it just, there's a mystery to it, and it's great. And you have no other hobby or passion other than what I had with Oilfield. But I was so young that I couldn't recognize the health concerns. And like Dad said, you know, until I got older, I could start to see the toll that it had taken, and that kind of makes you think a little bit more.
I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Story. I'm talking today with two oilmen, a father and son, Gary and Tug Iden. Tug, as it turned out, was left to make his own decision about what to do.
I remember one time after dinner one night, and it only occurred once, Dad had asked me, you know, do you really want to do the oil field? You could go be a doctor or do something else. But I just remember saying, you know, I think so. I think I want to do it. And haven't turned back from it. He took my word for it. He didn't question me or push me beyond that. He just asked me that one time, you know, do you really want to? Are you sure you want to do the oil field? Look what it's done to me. Look what it's done to your grandfather. And I said, yeah, this is what I want to do. And he's never questioned me. And he's always supported me for that.
Tug Iden went to college, taking the courses he'd need to become a petroleum engineer. His time in the field made his time in the classroom a lot easier to take.
Especially my freshman year, a lot of it was repetitive. They show you what a drilling rig is and how this works and how that works and... Well, we got to the point where they started listing pieces of the facilities that are directly on a gas well. That's everything I had grown up with and we've talked about in this discussion. Well, the professor had two of the pieces backwards. And after he had got done doing everything, nobody else knew the difference. But Tug had to raise his hand and just correct the professor. And he kind of looked at me for a second and he said, you know, you're right. Went back to the board, switched around and... He was actually good about it. He was lighthearted. But the other one, she didn't take it too well. And this is a small campus. So you can always tell when there's a little cold feeling going around.
You're glad you went to college, though, right?
Oh, absolutely. College has been the best thing I ever did for my career. I wouldn't trade my background for anything, though. I'm doing a job that if I hadn't gone to college, it takes guys 30 or 35 years of experience, just like Dad, to do. And, you know, the 4 years of college have enabled me to bypass that 30 years.
It was a good idea to go.
Oh, absolutely.
Did you ever sit your dad down and tell him that?
I think he knew. We never really ever had to come out and say, you know, that was a great idea going to college. Whenever I came home, we'd discuss stuff and talk about it, and we always knew that it was the better thing to do. And even though there was those times, like when I could have went to Iraq to fight fires or other jobs in college, I could have taken and I never did. And I think, we just both kind of looked back on it and said college was a good idea.
Gary, what about you? Was there a moment of particular pride for you? I don't know, graduation day or the day when he got the new job, that sort of thing?
Tug has actually been the first graduate that we've had in our family. Yeah, when Tug was graduated, that was one of the happiest days of my life, because he was our oldest, and he was kind of showed us how to motivate kids, get them into school, keep them in school. He didn't say nothing, but he's just set a lot of records in the oil companies already, and you know, he's just done really well. And that's what you hope for your children, that they grow up. You know, of course, they're going to have their own challenges, motivate their kids and show them how important school is.
I don't know. What do you think, Tug? You got a three-generation run in the oil industry going here. Your grandfather, your father, yourself. What are you going to tell your son or your daughter when they're born?
I don't know. I'll probably just let them do whatever they want to do.
It's funny, though. I wonder if there's still going to be as much work in the oil industry when they get around to it.
I think it's going to stabilize. I don't see it growing too much. So I think I'm probably the tail end of a generation.
When Tug Iden was on his way to getting that degree, though, there were still times when he was tempted to leave, to grab a job offer, to start making money.
You know, after he had convinced me to go to school and I gave up the job on the rig, and you would think that would be the end of it. But even in college, I got a lot of jobs, got a lot of job offers, and I turned a bunch down. But there was one my junior year at the beginning of the Iraq War. There was some concerns that they were going to light some more wells on fire. And I actually had the paperwork signed, and I was all but packed up to go over to Iraq to help put out these fires with a certain company. And in the end, it never happened. It never came about. So I never did get to go, but it would have been great money, and I was loving it, and I think it made Dad pretty nervous thinking about it.
Yeah, it did. It was a continual challenge to keep him in school because people kept trying to hire him, and I didn't appreciate from the people that were recruiting these kids. That was probably one of the toughest for Tug to get over and we had to work on him all summer on that one.
Tell me something, Gary. Okay. Was there ever a story that you told him, the son of another roughneck who's your age, or someone you said, hey, you know, I understand it, but look at the case of this guy or look at this example. Was there any one compelling story that you were able to use to help make your case?
Well, we have several friends that are independent consultants or have worked for big corporations, and they're the same age as I am, but they look like they're 20 years younger, you know, because they've had corporate jobs, office jobs. They sit in and look around. And plus, even though I've got a lot of experience, I'm not really hireable. I'd like to go out and teach school, for example, because I don't have a degree in it. And so I just show them these other guys. Say, hey, listen, this is what these guys are making good money. You can make $1,200 a day plus expenses, $1,500 a day plus expenses. I mean, he could compare me with other people, some of our friends, and see what kind of lifestyle they had. You know, they actually had vacations. They could afford to go someplace, you know.
You're listening to The Story. I'm Dick Gordon. Tug Iden now has a desk job as a petroleum engineer. He doesn't get out on the derrick anymore. And though he likes the six-figure salary, he admits he occasionally misses the feel of that Wyoming wind.
There's a lot of adrenaline rushes with it. It's dangerous work. There's times where you're absolutely scared to death and you have to evacuate, you know, and the whole location, give everybody off but yourself and somebody else to do a certain job. And there's times where you don't know what's going to happen. And
it's the testing, right? It's testing your body. It's, can I do this?
Oh, yeah, physically and mentally as well. You know, it takes a certain guy to be able to stare down, you know, several thousand PSI and hope everything goes well.
Gary, as I listen to Tug talk about what the downside, the dangerous side of the industry is, there must be a times or a part of you that's kind of glad that he's not out there and exposed to it every day like you are.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's what we wanted. As far as me envying Tug, the only thoughts I have is I wish I'd have done the same thing 35 years ago instead of coming up the way I have. Now, envy Tug's money, of course. I can, and he won't ship it home. They always tell me when your kids get out there, they ship that money home, but I ain't seen a nickel of it.
Gary, I want to thank you for being with me. Appreciate your time.
Well, sure. We enjoyed it.
And Tug, thank you for your time as well.
Yeah, thank you.
Tug Iden joined me from a studio in Dallas. His father, Gary, in typical form, drove from Wyoming through a snowstorm to our studios in Salt Lake City. It's stories like Tug and Gary's that give us insight into the way that businesses are changing and our lives are changing and the way that fathers and sons, mothers and daughters interrelate. If you have a suggestion of a story that shines that kind of a light on what's going on in the country, I'd love to hear from you. Our website is thestory.org. Just send me a couple of lines there. We'll get in touch with you. Our next story this hour is also one about a passion for work. Frank Harmon is an architect who grew up in the South without ever giving a lot of thought to the architecture he saw all around him. He knows now that there is both beauty and wisdom in the design of something as simple as a front porch. I'll talk with Frank Harmon in just a moment. I'm Dick Gordon from American Public Media. This is The Story. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story. If you find yourself in a conversation about architecture these days, you're likely to be drawn into talking about what's new in green architecture, ways to make a home fit into the landscape, ways to make use of the sun and the seasons to your own best advantage. Frank Harmon is an architect in Raleigh, North Carolina, who has studied and taught and worked in different parts of the world. And although he was trained in the tradition of the modern movement, he realized on his own that some of the best of green architecture is found in the simplicity and the elegance of the older buildings we see around us every day. He told me about a classic old barn on his Uncle Emmett's farm in Tennessee, hayloft up high, animals down below.
Mostly I remember the barn as a place of immense fun, you know, to have so many extraordinary spaces up under the eaves filled with hay, and the smell of these animals and the sight of the cornfields beyond was quite breathtaking.
Were you allowed to sort of play at will in the barn then?
Absolutely at will, and to improvise, and it was the ideal playground for children, in my opinion, because we could totally use our own imaginations.
My recollection of my own time in friends' barns is that there was always a big door that would slide open, which was good for an afternoon's fun, or ropes hanging from the loft, which are good for another afternoon's fun, or
yes. You know,
a set of stairs that went down through the center of the barn to where the animals were kept. I mean, it's almost like it was designed as a play area for children. I don't know.
We certainly interpreted it that way.
Were you there with cousins, brothers? Was it a sort of passel of kids?
Brother and two sisters, mostly. We had a... You know, there were four children in our family, and we all went together.
You weren't clearly thinking a whole lot about architecture at that time. When was the moment when you realized there was such a thing as architecture? Do you remember that?
I was in Miss Dickinson's eighth grade English class in Greensboro, North Carolina, junior high school. And I remember looking out the window across the street at this large wood-framed house with great porches and shaded by trees. And for the first time, it occurred to me, you know, how did that house get there? Someone must have imagined that house before it was built. Houses don't grow like plants. And I then found out that that person was an architect, and it preoccupied me for years after that. Although my parents' wish was for me to become a doctor, I determined that I would be an architect.
At eighth grade, that's young to have that kind of, to develop that kind of interest.
Yes, it actually reinforced other things that I enjoyed doing, such as I used to build tree houses. I loved to make dams and streams. My favorite things to do used, in a sense, my three-dimensional imagination and my whole body, climbing, building things. I was not a good, what you call, book student, but I learned intuitively from the things around me.
Frank Harmon left his home in North Carolina to study and practice architecture in London. He was enchanted by the great cathedrals of the city, but it was an unexpected trip to the countryside that changed his perspective.
As students in London, we were coached and trained in what's called the modern movement. And for us, modernity and technology, these were the ways of the future, and that's what we would learn the most from. But at some point, I had a history course taught by John Brandon Jones, who lectured to us on the arts and crafts movement. Now, I'd never heard of this arts and crafts movement, but it sounded interesting. And he talked about this one house in particular called Standon in East Grinstead in Sussex. And he showed us images of it, and I said, "Now that looks very interesting." And he happened to mention that the daughter of the man who built it still lived there, and it was possible to go and visit. Well, that weekend I phoned her, and I took the train down to East Grinstead and left the train station and walked probably 4 miles through the English countryside, past cottages made of stone and some brick and wood, and I arrived at Standon, and it was a truly remarkable building. I had tea with Miss Beale, who was the daughter of the man who built it, and she talked about William Morris and Philip Webb, who were the architects and designers of the building, and how they cared for everything in the house, whether it was a clump of lavender or the structure of the roof. And there was nothing in the house that was unfinished. In fact, you could go up in the attic, and it was as carefully made in the space that no one ever saw as the drawing room floor. This house was built of stone that's cut right out of the hillside next to the house. It was made of brick that was dug from the clay nearby and fired in kilns that they built there. The wood on the house was elm from trees they'd cut on the land and cured over the winter and put into place on the building. And at that time, the house was over 100 years old, and it looked like it was 10 years old. Because so well was it built that it weathered comfortably and just fitted into its place. So I had my visit. We had tea. I said goodbye, and I walked back to the train station, and it was as though the scales had fallen off my eyes because I saw all of these cottages that and barns and outbuildings that I'd passed before in a new way, that they had this instinctively appropriate use of materials that was suited to that particular place in England and no other. And I later learned that those architects, Philip Webb and William Morris, always started out when they had a house or a building to design or a church by looking at the way untrained, i.e. non-architect builders, had built there in the preceding century.
And to listen to your description of the materials, I hear the same kind of language that we hear today when people talk about sustainable building, that you need to figure out what's around and, you know, not be importing rainforest Brazilian wood in from somewhere else. I mean, you know,
you
know much more about this than I do. But the language that you're using hasn't changed. In fact, it's almost more in fashion than it perhaps ever was.
Well, we did forget it for many years. And as I say, being trained as a young modernist, we thought that we could draw on any material. It didn't matter where it came from as long as it was white or transparent.
When you saw Standon House and had that first-hand description of how it was built, how it was designed and how it was built, and you saw how it had weathered and you sat in there, then you're walking back and you see these other places that are so similar. What was new to you there? What What did you realize that you had not realized before? Because you would have been taught in class about the appropriateness of using local material and the quality of good craftsmanship.
Well, no, as I say, we weren't taught those things. We were taught that the new architecture was going to be made of mass-produced, industrialized, perfect materials such as steel and glass and concrete. And here were buildings made of things that either grew or could be extracted from the earth nearby. And partly as a result of that, these buildings seemed to belong to their place. So what I saw when I walked back to the train station was not only the lesson that these buildings could teach, but their great beauty that I hadn't seen before.
You're listening to The Story. I'm Dick Gordon. As Frank Harmon walked back to his train that day and looked at the way that the cottages fit into the land, he was drawn to think once again of his Uncle Emmett's old barn and the way it also seemed to belong in its place. When he returned to North Carolina, he found himself searching out buildings, old homes and farmhouses that had been built before 1940, before the innovation of, for example, air conditioning. There was one old abandoned farm that he passed by regularly.
And what you see when you're looking at it from the highway is a pond, and on a low hill beyond the pond is the farmhouse, and in the distance beyond that is a barn and a silo. Well, what that means is that the wind, a prevailing wind in the summer, which comes from the southwest, passed over that pond, so it was cooled on a hot summer evening, and then up and through the house, so it automatically cooled the house. Of course, the pond was there to water the farmer's livestock, but it also cooled his house. The house faced due south, so it would catch the sun in the winter, but its big porch would shade the house in the summer. And the barn, which is over there in the distance, which we always take for granted, well, a farmer has a barn, it's on the lee side of the house because the barn is where the smells and the insects are. And you don't want the wind blowing those into your house. You want the wind to take them away. I realized suddenly that all of these things this farmer did, he did quite naturally, but it was also a matter of survival. You know, the health of his children depended on the house being on a low rise so it drained well, so that the pond could cool the house, and so that the flies and diseases could be kept away from the house.
It's interesting to listen to you describe it, because I'm drawn to ask, do you think it was all done on purpose or almost out of instinct that this is the proper way to order the buildings and the land? And do you see what I'm saying?
Oh, I think traditionally farmers had an instinctive understanding of their land. For example, they never built on the best part of the land. They saved that for their crops because that was their sustenance. They typically built on a low rise for good drainage. They knew exactly where the breezes came from to cool their house or their barns or their chickens. They knew how to plant trees for shade. They would shade the house in the summer, but the leaves would fall off in the winter and the sun could come through and warm the house. One only has to travel through North Carolina or indeed Virginia or Georgia to see these patterns repeated over and over. And there's no such thing as a textbook about them. It's never been written down. And it leads me to believe that it was an instinctive or what you might call a vernacular approach towards design. And ultimately, I think it's the most profound way to approach design, because here are people who are making the house that they will live in themselves.
Frank Harmon says this kind of local wisdom is easily applied to the buildings that he designs today. He favors lots of glass and flat roofs with a big overhang.
I had a client several years ago who had an ancient sand dune at the beach that was covered in live oak trees on a 3-acre piece of land. And his family loved to picnic on that little mossy covered sand dune with the trees on it. And when I came to design the house, they said, "You know, Frank, that's where we want the house. We just love picnicking here, and we'd like for you to put the house there." And I managed to explain to them that if I did that, then they wouldn't have that place anymore. And so we built the house about 200 feet away, and to this day it overlooks that mossy knoll.
And they continue to picnic.
They continue to picnic there. Yes. So I would say the primary principle is listen to the land.
What about the walls of glass, though, and your interest in a flat roof rather than a standard V-shaped roof. Where's that from?
It comes from growing up as a child in Greensboro, North Carolina, and loving to be outdoors. And my favorite experiences and memories of childhood are outdoors, sometimes in barns, but more often under trees or following the course of streams. And I find that I share that with many people. Most of my clients come to me saying, we want a sense of the outdoors in our buildings. So you will see a lot of glass in my buildings, but its glass is very carefully placed. To have a large wall of glass that faces south or west is an environmental recipe for disaster. In Raleigh, for example, our greatest energy needs are for cooling, not for heating. Mm-hmm. So if I can make a house open to the north, which is incidentally very nice because the sun never shines in your eyes and you're looking out over a backlit landscape, I'll do it. Where I use glass on other sides of the house, I'll shade them either with trees or porches. Or
a good long overhang of the roof.
A very deep overhang. And that's why you often sense in my buildings there's a big roof, because a lot of that roof is the overhang. Overhangs also create a sense of shelter around the house. I think every house or building ought to have places where we can step outside comfortably and have a cup of coffee no matter what the weather is. And deep overhangs give us that. And deep overhangs also make the house seem to belong to the land, because they usually follow the slope of the land.
You're listening to The Story. I'm Dick Gordon. Frank Harmon's ideas about a kind of sustainable architecture weren't always so attractive. He says he struggled for some time with the idea that Southern design had anything to offer.
Having grown up in the South, I was actually ashamed of being from the South, as many of us were. People from the South talked slow, and of course when I moved to great metropolitan centers like London and later New York, I found that Southerners were made fun of, and it was not something that I celebrated, or I wouldn't allow myself to celebrate it. However, when I moved back to North Carolina in 1982, I did see the South in a new way, that it had much more to offer than most people realized.
I mean, when you think about it, I don't know if there's a chapter in a book anywhere that's titled Southern Architecture, but you've just described that to me, right? Not something that comes out of a classroom, but something that just comes out of the wisdom of generations of doing this.
I taught for over 20 years at NC State. I taught students how to become architects. And what I told them was that you already know what makes a good building. You know what a good room is when you walk into it. You know that a street feels safe when you walk down it. We all know these things. We've grown up with them. My task is to help you recognize them and articulate what's good or what's bad about them, and to be able to use these qualities of buildings in the work that you do.
That would take a fair amount of confidence for someone to say, I don't have all the knowledge you have, and I'm just going to help you with that.
Well, it's always been my belief as a practicing architect that people know what makes a good building. They know when a porch is comfortable. They know that this is a bedroom they like to wake up in. And if I can get my clients to trust themselves and not feel like they have to go to experts like Martha Stewart to tell them what makes a good room, they know it themselves, then they're going to find a way to do that.
Frank Harmon has another theory about architecture. He told me he believes that all of our own personal sense of comfort on the land comes directly from that first half acre of land we grew up on.
My own experience of that was a stream in Greenway Park in Greensboro, North Carolina, where I grew up, and I can safely say that most of what I do as an architect today is based on what I learned playing in that stream. How water flows, where water comes from, what difference a rain makes, what kind of plants grow near a stream, what kind of plants grow on the banks, what kind of bird builds a hole in the bank, that's a kingfisher, what kind of bird nests in the trees, where the tadpoles are. And these are all a way of illustrating that nature and life generally is this wonderfully interdependent web that, as architects and people living on the earth, we get to fit into, you know.
Frank Harmon is an architect in Raleigh, North Carolina. We have a link to his website at our website. You can see examples of his work, and there's also a sketch there of his Uncle Emmett's barn. That's all at thestory.org. And if you have your own suggestions of people who have a different way of looking at our world, people whose ideas influence the way the rest of us look at the world, get in touch with me. Go to our website, thestory.org, and leave me a message there. Or just call me and leave me a short note on our telephone line at 1-888-966-9862. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story.
The Story is a production of North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill.
American Public Media.